I am Jerry Pedersen, and this is the second in a series on nonviolence. And we're going to look at nonviolence as the way of Jesus, the way of nonviolence. Yeah, and let me just review one thing. When you talk about nonviolence, I like to recall the story of St. Francis at Gibeo, a village that had a problem because there was a fierce wolf that continually every day came in and because it was hungry, ravaged the people, sometimes bit people, and was causing havoc. So they asked Francis to help. St. Francis came in, and he negotiated a contract between the wolf and the people, that the people would feed the wolf. They would take food out every day to the edge of the village, and then the wolf would have something to eat, and then he wouldn't bother the people anymore. I don't know about the story, but it reflects this thought that there is a fierce wolf, not just in other people, but in all of us. There is in our dark side, in the shadow side of our being, we know violence. We know, we want vengeance. We all have to deal with that. And I believe nonviolence is, we need to help ourselves as well as help others and help the world to learn this transformation and, in a sense, the taming of the violent wolf in each of us, so that, in fact, we learn how to deal with relationships at all levels in a different way than through the act of violence. Just a little bit, a reflection on peace. My problem with pacifism, especially, is that the word pacifism suggests being passive, or at least I thought so. And it didn't appeal to me. The whole idea of peace. You know, people sometimes come up to the casket at a funeral and look at the person and say, aren't they peaceful? You know? And that's, it's this idea that peace is somehow the absence of conflict. Now it is the absence. Well, it isn't even the absence of conflict, because life is vigorous. It has all kinds of conflicts in it. So we have to somehow have to understand peace as not the absence of conflict, but some other way. One story is that there was a contest for who could paint the best picture of peace. And it came down to two finalists. One person painted a tranquil meadow scene, beautiful scene, grass, flowers growing, trees out at the edges. It was so peaceful and it was beautiful. And many thought that should win the prize. Then there was another picture that had a waterfall coming over a cliff. It was just rampaging down, pulmoting down the cliff. But right in the middle of this waterfall, powerful as the waterfall was, there was a rock jutting out. And sitting on the rock, there was a little bird. And the bird was just sitting there, chirping, chirping away, you know. They finally awarded the prize to that one, because it wasn't this tranquil scene. It was this bird in the midst of turbulence. That, they said, that's true peace. And for a long time, I that's kind of a story I like to use. And it's good, except it's not quite adequate, because peace, the peace word in Scripture, the basic one is shalom, and shalom is a relationship word. Shalom means to be in right relationship to everything that's around you. You're in right relationship to, you know, your family, your children, your parents, your wife or husband, or you're at peace with your community, your neighbors. You're at peace with the world you're in. You know, you're in peace with God. But it's also, you're healthy. You have enough food to eat. You have the security of a good house. Shalom is to be in right relationship with all things. And so that it's a communal thing. And this little bird sitting there on the rock in the midst of a waterfall is too individualistic. And that was the only criticism I would have of that, is that too often when we think of peace, we think of it as an individualistic concern. Peace of mind, peace of soul, you know, and it's no matter what's happening out there in the world, we have peace. And in our churches, sometimes I think we're content to leave people with this feeling of, you know, to be at peace with God and feel serenity without sensing that we are part of a society where there's all kinds of wrong relationships. And in one sense, a person that thinks that can have total peace in a relaxed manner, that's too selfish, it's too individualistic. Yeah. Not that we shouldn't have that.
Since I've been here, I'm so concerned about Bosnia and different things like that. I can't find any recent paper, I didn't bring any radio. And when I voiced that, they say, oh, it's so nice to be away from the TV. And I feel relationship all the time with the whole,
beautiful,
whole world. Yeah. But do you feel that?
I had that concern with the whole world, yes. And if something's happening in Bosnia, there's not peace in the world because, well, obviously, yeah, I sense that too. What's happening out in the real world? And that's such a... That's so critical these days because there is a little hope. Unfortunately, it's a hope that comes...
I pray over my newspaper when there's something that is a possibility either way. I immediately hold that in prayer, and yeah. I miss it here.
Yeah. Well, we've included it in our prayers and vespers and such.
Yeah, but you don't know what's happening.
I know, but sometimes you need to get away a little bit so you can come back and get some more perspective.
Don't give me more of that.
You got to go up the mountain once in a while, or you got to go down in the valley. The important thing is, do you return? Yeah. Well, today, just this was introductory comments. Yesterday, someone said, well, why don't we get into specifically what nonviolence is? And tomorrow, I'm going to get into that more specifically. We're going to look at the Sermon on the Mount, and where Jesus says, you've heard an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, and this whole revenge concept. But he says, I say unto you, and we'll be looking at that more closely, how Jesus spoke to and dealt with this question. By the way, this is nonviolence. It's not whatever we shifted rooms on. So I want to ask the question, what is violence? Because we have a tendency to limit what we see violence being. We limit it to too narrow a focus in today's world. And for a good deal of this, I'm relying on Robert McAfee Brown's book, Religion and Violence. And although there's a new edition since this came out, it's still a basic thing. I encourage anyone, it's in the bookstore, I'd encourage you to get it, or if you don't have it. Almost always, we describe violence as an overt physical act of destruction. Webster's dictionary describes violence as the exertion of any physical force considered with reference to its effect on another than the agent. Or the Eisenhower Commission that studied violence in America defined it as behavior designed to inflict physical injury to people or damage to property. Now, that's violence, all right, that which does physical injury to others or to property. But does that go far enough in considering what we're talking about when we talk about violence, and especially for advocates of nonviolence? And so Brown lists a sort of a spectrum of different types of violence. And I want to put them on the board. He lists, which is better, black? I guess so. He lists personal, overt, physical, assault. He says you assault.
A-U.
A-U, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, L-T. I'm a poor speller, and when I get to the board, I'm terrible. So this is the first time, and what are some examples of personal, overt, physical assault? What are some examples?
Drive-by shooting.
Hitting another, drive-by shooting. Okay.
Child abuse, wife abuse.
Excuse me, I did.
Child abuse.
Child
abuse, husband abuse.
Child abuse, okay.
But it doesn't need to be necessarily physical, does it?
Well, then, I was questioning, if it's physical child abuse, then it fits under this category. Mm-hmm. You know, attacking or rape or sexual molestation or something of that sort. This is the kind of thing we quickly think of. One of the difficulties with when Jesus dealt with the issue, somebody strikes you in the cheek. Well, that's physical, personal, overt assault, and requires you to go a mile. That's pretty physical. Any other examples that you? Well, Brown lists a second category that's still personal. What are we doing here? Excuse me, it's not personal. That's why I thought something wrong. It's institutional. Institutional overt physical assault. Overt physical assault, but it's institutionalized now. It's no longer just personal. What would be an example?
War.
Okay. War is a classic example.
Prison.
Slavery. Yeah. What?
Would slavery come under institutional, or would that be a cultural?
Slavery. Thing? Sure. It's you know, using another person in a very physical way, but it's now institutionalized. And of course, some of those slave masters were loving, weren't they? Oh yes, they treated their slaves so well. They fed them good. Yes, but it was still an institutionalized, socialized form of a violent situation.
Corporation support of violence and the labor movement, labor.
Okay.
Denying labor.
Okay. We're going to have another category
that fits
that better and somewhat fits this. Yeah. Capital punishment would surely come under this, wouldn't it? It's taking life. It's a violent act. Killing another is surely a violent act, but it's institutionalized. Now it's socialized. It's acceptable.
Chain gangs, if they've been instituting again. Chain gangs.
Chain gangs, surely. You bet. It's rationalized as an acceptable social act for whatever reasons. But it's obviously a violent act. Well, then he lists another dimension. It's personal, but it's now covert, and it's personal covert violence. It's personal, just as number one was, but now it's covert instead of overt. Covert being not physical on the outside, something that's observable, but it's inward in the person. It's not visible in itself other than its consequences. It's when one person violates the personhood of another person that are psychologically destructive. They may not be physically harmful directly, but they're psychologically harmful. What are some examples for this?
Neglect.
Neglect?
Neglect of the elderly, neglect of children, neglect of, I think.
Just neglect itself and all the consequences that flow from it, right.
Verbal abuse
of another. What's wrong with you? Can't you ever do anything right? You know, why do you always do things wrong? Why do you always, you know, pretty soon this kid, you know, hasn't been slapped, hasn't been hit, but starts thinking, hey, why do, I'm a person that always fails. I never do anything right. That's who I am. Yeah.
Or a husband feels that way. I observe that a husband can be abused that way by his wife.
Sure, husband abuse.
Work the other way too.
Yeah.
Well,
yes.
Or wife. Right. What was that?
Could work the other way too, vice versa.
Sure.
But, you know, wife can be abused that way too.
Thank you for saying that. By the way, I would, if you speak up as much as you can, partly because I'm partly deaf. But also because we want to pick things up on the tape. So first reason is the real reason, though. Okay, what else?
Probably things that are sold to us that have a detrimental effect to our well-being, things on the market that are maybe a car that isn't manufactured correctly.
That probably comes in the next category. Let's the next one, because the next one is institutional. Covert violence. It's covert. It's not war. It's not capital punishment. Anything like that. It's an inward thing, but it's an institutionalized act which formerly we would call a personal thing. And so you're saying advertising or influences,
tobacco industry.
That tobacco industry would be a good example.
Automobiles that are lemons are
okay. Unsafe things in the, okay.
I wonder about internet, whether internet is a very serious matter for the future, that it can be insidious and give backing to such hatreds or prejudices. I'm really worried the way that people will just sit and have access to either send it out on the internet or for the people there.
Yeah, that's such a new area, and I really, I'm so unfamiliar with the computer world and all that, but I have a hunch that we've unleashed fantastic possibilities, but possibilities always include the possibility of evil or destructive elements.
Beings have really got to grow up.
Uh-huh.
And face this, yeah, in order to survive the world, help the world survive.
Some more examples of institutionalized covert violence.
Well, that would be the prison system, which wants to punish and thinks more years in prison or death or whatever the hell is going to solve things rather than trying to reform, give opportunities for education, etc., to the prisoners.
Yeah. Oh, the whole prison system. It's a, it's surely not, doesn't lead to restitution or to transformation of people's behavior. We know that our prison system is just the opposite. It's at the, because we've neglected investment in all kinds of other areas, that we have to now invest in prison systems to deal with a problem that would have been better attacked at a different place. Yeah. Other examples.
My daughter works in a correctional institute. She teaches. And it's quite a new institution. It looks almost like a college campus. And they have had lovely tennis courts and volleyball courts and things. But now the pressure is on so great that these prisoners are not supposed to enjoy these things, and they're wiped out.
Yes.
In this prison now, they have no more volleyball, no more basketball and all that, because it's just too good for the prisoners. She has some comments about this.
Yeah. Well, we can't afford to do that, so squeeze them into more quarters.
Now, yeah.
It's interesting, down in our county court, they're trying to sue the sheriff because he's turning prisoners out early. And he says, I haven't got enough prison space, and we've got them doubled up. We're violating the law by pressuring. And so if you have 2 months to serve and he can get you out in 3 weeks, he does it. You know, and of course he's coming under all kind of criticism, and you know, his answer is there'll be more prisons then. But that's not the answer. Other situations of institutionalized.
Well, the television, film industry, you know, that whole.
Wow. Yeah. Yeah. Tell a little bit more about that.
Well, the acceptable role models, behavior for how we can treat one another, how we can, the people are very disposable, the kind of racism that pervades, that darker skinned people are generally more evil in film and TV, and uglier people are more evil, and overweight people are more evil. I mean, there's kind of, that just comes through over and over again.
Yeah, I like realism in a film, say. But isn't it wonderful once in a while to just go and see something idealistic and beautiful? And I saw Dangerous Minds the other day. Anybody seen that? It's a woman who becomes a teacher in a school situation, and it's almost all Latino or black, and it's you know, they're going to drive her out of there, and she recognizes them as real people, and she captures their interest and all, and somehow it you just come out and feeling there is hope, you know, and we need so much more of that. We can't be just our heads in the sky either. But
Apollo 13 is a good one too.
The
Apollo 13.
Is it? I haven't seen that.
I want to say the word thing about the prison. Carl Menninger called the prison system the crime of punishment.
Crime, yeah. Crime of punishment. Excellent. Excellent, yeah. How about racism? Mm-hmm. Racism is, it's what was slavery is almost now passed on into racism. And there's no question that you can analyze our society in terms of race and see all kinds of injustices involved. It's institutionalizing what many persons wouldn't be guilty of. In my congregation, if a black person or a person of color, and I'm no longer the pastor there, no longer 3 years, but anyone that came around, they would be treated caringly. You know, if it was a matter of they needed money or food or maybe help get a job or something. Personally, they would not be guilty of a, quote, racist act. But they were involved in a society where racism is just so institutionalized that, first of all, they all moved out to Southern Orange County. That's where I am. they wanted to escape, you know, all the problems of the inner city and all that. So they all moved out seeking a place where they really don't have to encounter much race. And if there are blacks or Latinos or others in our area, they're just about a second middle class as the rest of us, you know. They've learned the rules of social behavior, and they probably have a decent income and so on. And if you try to deal with racism, the institutionalized form of it, I'd encounter all kind of reaction. Whereas if we talked about personal acts of racism or concern, yeah, they were right there. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the reality is, and this is what I'm going to move on to now. Well, a couple of other things. Redlining, trying to buy a house, and to get a loan in certain areas is almost impossible, or you have to pay a higher interest rate, or insurance costs if you live in a inner city or ghetto or something. Inferior schooling, that's institutionalized violence. Poverty itself, it's institutionalized in the sense that it reproduces itself, just the consequences of being poor almost guarantees the perpetuation of that in future generations and all. All the consequences that came to it. By the way, let me just ask you a question. What do you know about Helen Keller?
She was blind.
And you can't say it because I pulled this on you already, didn't I?
Yeah.
What do you know about Helen Keller?
She was blind, but she overcame it.
Right. What else?
That's the question. What?
Who was Helen Keller?
Oh.
She was a blind child. She overcame it.
She became a teacher.
Excuse me?
She became a teacher.
She became a teacher, yes.
She could not hear.
She also couldn't hear, right. Mm-hmm. And?
And she had to learn how to speak.
She had to. And Ann Sullivan, the teacher that met her. Yeah. And what else do we know about her? I ask this because I just got a book, Lies My Teacher Told Me. It's a study of the American, of high school textbooks and what they teach and what they don't teach. And they take 12 basic textbooks that are used in high schools and analyze them. It's fantastic. Helen Keller, and almost every one of them refers to Helen Keller. They tell what you told me. And that's what I knew about Helen Keller. A couple of more little things. But they're almost all of the childhood, and I think she became a teacher. Actually, she went to Radcliffe College, and she became a socialist while she was there. And she became not only a socialist, she became a radical socialist. She became a member She supported Eugene Debs for president in every election in which he ran. You know, he was running as the socialist candidate. She spoke all of her life about the wonderful communist event that happened in Russia, praised that whole system. She contributed to the IWW, the International Workers of the World, the Radical Communist Union. She contributed to the beginning of the NAACP, which this is nonviolent. You're welcome to us if that's where you're coming.
Well, I was just going to take. That's all right.
Okay. What I'm trying to say, that's not reported. Because that's, you don't tell those things. That's not acceptable in our society. You have to make heroes, and heroes all have to contribute to progress. The names of textbooks are The Adventure of America, or, I forget the names of them. But we, after all, are the best country in the world, aren't we? The most peace-loving and giving And very few books suggest anything else. Well, I bring this up in terms of institutionalization of misinformation.
Do you have the author of that book?
I don't. I'd never heard of the person, but it just was published, I believe, in January. So it's Lies My Teacher Told Me. And it goes through a whole spectrum of things and simply says, these books say this and they don't say this. Mm-hmm. And most of it, and what they say is, he asks college students as freshmen, what do you know about this? And people come in with a perception of American history that's just totally out of touch with reality. And he says, why don't they mention these things? And of course, he is a history prof, and he wants to present history as something other than just learning a bunch of facts and events. And the way the textbooks tend to describe it is, this just kind of unfolded. And this is just the way it happened. This is the way it was. When in fact, history is the ground in which all kind of conflicting ideas and controversies, and there's always different sides, and then something happens. But if you don't understand the process of why this comes about, you really haven't learned much from history. And he also he says very few of them relate what took place then to the situation right now. And students ought to be preparing in history to think through, and what are the issues and the controversies of our day? And what are the elements that go into having to resolve those issues? But as a consequence, it says, history is always listed by most students as the most boring of subjects. Almost everybody says that. It's boring because it's just facts that just happened to fall out of the sky. This is the way it happened. Whereas, in fact, they're exciting issues that lead up to any of these. And then we get them through filtered glasses as we're presenting them to people. Well, I want to go on. We started.
Hasn't someone produced a new history book, and their criticism is that it leaves out all of the good things that we've been taught, and it doesn't mention them at all?
So. Yeah, he deals with that. Of course, he says, first of all, that's not what's happening in textbook production. But he says, yes, we have to present, good interpretations as well as the things that aren't so good. But not to be aware is to repeat the mistakes. That's what was an example? Oh, an example, he taught in a Mississippi school, which was totally black for a while. And he asked the students, after the Civil War, some big changes were made in education and all in the South, under pressure from 30 feet. And many blacks were elected to the legislatures for the first time. But within 10 years, after Northern presence and all was excluded, within 10 years, all of these had almost come totally white instructed again. Total segregation, very few blacks in legislatures or anything like that. And the blacks themselves said the reason for this is that when blacks got into positions of leadership in school teachers, especially in legislatures, it was chaotic. They had no experience, they had no abilities. It was just a chaotic situation. It was a failure of leadership. And finally, whites had to step back in because the blacks were incapable of really ruling, of being part of the ruling process. And he says, that's just not true. There's just no truth to that at all. And he gives many, many examples of that. And so the trouble with not dealing with that is that it builds up a false expectation, which now, 75 or 100 years later, many blacks still see, yeah, blacks just have not had this. We're incapable of doing that. This was the image they had of themselves. And as a teacher, he was trying to say, wait a minute, this is what happened in Mississippi. And he shows all the positive things that really did happen, and that white taking back the power was not because of failure and chaos. It was much more simply return to power and the whole segregated system. So, well, I want to shift. We go till 11:30, and so I thought I planned to get to this earlier, but you people talk too much. Or is it me that talks too much? I want to talk a little bit about why. The reason I want to do this is that to take the approach of nonviolence has to come to terms with dealing with these levels here, as well as to only reacting to personal, overt, physical assault. I wish we could have time. Michael Cosby has written a book, Praying the Lord's Prayer as a Subversive Activity. And what he says is that he believes new converts, when they were being instructed into the Christian life in the first century, second century, first couple of centuries, that the prayer was one of those sort of secret documents that was not given out to the public out there. That was part of the final instructions in the Christian life. Because he says the prayer was a subversive activity. And in as simple as to recognize that, he says, to say our Father was subversive. Because in the Roman Empire, allegiance was given to the emperor. In name, he is the Holy One. Total obedience and submission must be offered to him. And to start saying the prayer is our Father, there's another authority that has our allegiance over that to the state, is to commit a subversive act. It's a radical act that makes you subject to death, to martyrdom. And so it was part of the of private instruction. And he goes on to discuss this. But he talks about the institutionalized violence that is so instrumental on most of our lives that we as Christians typically only talk about violence on the as a personal act, or as an interpersonal act, me acting against you, or in a group, or in a family, or so. But he said his argument is that in our day, it's institutionalized violence that is the great sin of our society. And that our participation in it is so subtle that generally we're guilty of participating in the sin of institutional violence to such an extent that, to try to convert people to the Christian faith and only deal with personal sin or interpersonal sin doesn't enable people to really be converted to Jesus, because the sin that has us all tied in knots is institutionalized sin, and the church hasn't tended to deal with that. And I want to use what Dawn Helder Camara calls the spiral of violence. And he lays out three levels of violence. It's the same kind of thing, but looked at in a little different way, and I think it can be helpful. He is an archbishop in Brazil, Roman Catholic. He says their country is in a revolutionary situation in the sense that the mass of people, especially the Indian, the peasant, the great mass of marginalized working people live in such poverty and devastation. At the same time, there's a very strong, wealthy, elite class of people, and this is getting wider and wider. By the way, I'm talking about Brazil, not the United States.
It's getting but wider.
Maybe
States.
I should be talking about the United States. But he says that one way or another, they have to deal with that. And of course, for a very long time, they dealt with it with militant power to hold down any form of insurrection or call for change. And he himself, he's been called a communist. And anybody ever seen Helder Camara, Don Helder? He's a little short fella. He's smiling. He's the most joyful. He's like Mother Teresa, even in a sense more so. He's so utterly Christian, but he's calling for changing institutions of society because of their violence. He talks about violence in three forms. He calls the basic form of violence the violence of injustice. It's what we've called the hidden or covert violence that doesn't necessarily do physical harm to people, but it destroys their personhood, their from in a sense their own self-image and within, and all of its consequences. It's the subtle institutionalized destruction of human possibilities that is around us all the time, but is not apparent to those who are comfortably situated. Thomas Aquinas, back in 12th or 13th century, the theologian said that unjust laws are acts of violence. If a law is not derived from the eternal law, framed according to the proper use of reason, it's a wicked law. And so, lacking the true nature of law, it's a kind of violence. And you know, we tend to talk about law and order. We got to have law and order. But he says a good deal of law can be disorder itself. It's a violent thing. And generally in a society, when they talk about violence, they want to talk only about the first or maybe the second sometimes. President Johnson, back in the 60s, appointed a commission to study the causes of violence. And they studied this for a couple of years. This resulted from all the things that were happening during the Vietnam War and student unrest and all. And this is a quote from that. The way we can make the greatest progress towards reducing violence in America is by taking the actions necessary to improve the conditions of family and community life for all who live in our cities, and especially for the poor who are concentrated in the ghetto slums. To make violence unnecessary, our institutions must be capable of providing justice for all who live under them. And then it goes on and says, violence has usually been the lava flowing from the top of a volcano, fed by the deep fires of social dislocation and injustice. It has not been stopped solely by capping the top, but has usually subsided only when our political and social institutions have managed to make the adjustment necessary to cool the fires below. Do you get that? What he's saying is violence, that commission said, violence is the lava flowing off of a volcano. Hey, it kills, it burns, it destroys. And what causes that violence of the lava of a volcano? Well, it's the injustice. It's the fires down beneath that are so hot that whoom, explodes and causes violence. Well, That's a good analogy, except the President's Commission said the violence is the lava. Now, the lava, which is it? Lava, yeah. The lava is violent, all right, but it doesn't describe the injustice of the fire as lava. And, you know, if you try to cap, it's like putting a tea kettle has some kind of a mechanism on the top so that when the steam comes, it'll blow the whistle or whatever it does. What if you cap that and keep heating the water on a tea kettle? What happens?
It explodes.
It explodes. It's that simple. And so, well, the commission basically was trying to say, we got to keep this explosion from happening. So let's see if we can do a few little acts so that we don't have an explosion. But it doesn't really seriously deal with the fire underneath.
The nature.
The real danger, yes.
Nature of what's... Reminds me of I don't know if any of you read the book by Scott Peck, Children of the Lie.
Ah, yeah.
Evil. Talked about evil in corporations, in mean life, and different things. But you think, what's causing all the problems to cause the eruption?
Yeah.
What's causing the violence? Is it the evil in people?
Yeah. Well, let me switch on.
To turn down the heat.
Okay.
Whatever that means.
Yeah. But it usually means just turn it down a little lower.
No.
So it'll simmer instead of explode. And, well, he goes on. He says there's a...
I should put these on the board. The spiral of violence. He says, one, injustice. Two, rebellion or revolt even. And then three, the third level is repression. Injustice, he calls basic violence. It's the root of everything. Then there are people, when they have had too much, you know, they'll tolerate a great deal. But when they've had too much, they're going to revolt. When the injustice society becomes too oppressive, violence number two, which Don Helder called revolt, bursts forth. Those who have been the victims of injustice finally decide that they must throw off the shackles of their oppression in the massive injustice they have suffered. This is the kind of violence which the President's Commission is concerned about, the lava flowing from the top of the volcano, fed by deeper fires of social dislocation and injustice. Violence as revolt is directed against the status quo. You know, whatever's causing this. Violence as revolt is directed against the status quo, against those who have the power and the responsibility for the injustice, for those who are, in a sense, benefiting from the status quo.
I think we see it in Mexico this time.
Chiapas? You bet. By those who feel that they have been denied justice, denied power, and their personhood is being denied. Now, hey, nobody likes revolt, but let me read a statement. Whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it, to institute new government. It is their right, it's their duty, to throw off such a government, and to provide new guards for their future security.
Doesn't sound like nonviolence. That's not nonviolence.
No. What am I reading from? Communist Manifesto?
It sounds like Jefferson
Yeah, it's from our Declaration of Independence. It's a classic statement of the right to revolt against injustice. It's as American as apple pie. Whenever any government or any society or any institutional network deprives this inalienable right, given to us in a sense by God, it's not given to us by governments, it's inalienable from us. It's our right. It's our obligation, our duty, it says. By the way, that quotation was circulated among a lot of people, and they asked, where do you, what are we quoting? More people thought it was from the Communist Manifesto than they thought it was from the Declaration of Independence. But it's the self-evident truth, an appropriate response, that whenever when an unjust situation exists, to revolt against it.
But whistleblowers don't get any. People who really are whistleblowers try to do that, and frequently are persecuted.
Absolutely.
For it.
Mm-hmm. Well, our time is just about up, but I have to. Repression is the third level of violence, he calls it. Just as violence number one, that is injustice, leads to violence number two, that is revolt, so does violence number two lead to number three, which Don Helder calls repression. Confronted with revolt, those who hold power put down the revolt by whatever means, repressive measures are needed, necessary to ensure that their power is not threatened. And this is the first response is, hey, we got to deal with this violence, and what? How do we do it? Well, we bring law and order into operation. And who makes laws? I've lived enough with blacks in our society to say, hey, the laws, that's the whitey's laws. That's not our laws. We didn't make them. Those are the laws formulated to protect their rights, their property, their situation, and to make sure that we didn't do anything to interfere. Hey, when we break the law, we're not breaking laws of mankind. No, we're not breaking God, laws of God. We're not breaking laws of the black man. We're breaking the gods of the slave owners. And there's something right. There's some truth to that. That it's, if in fact repression is exerted to put down revolt, to deal with rebellion, it can be violence, evil, wrong. Now, Helder says, you got to deal with violence. But if you're going to deal with violence, the place is to not look at the revolt. If you want to deal with violence and bring it into it, you got to look at the injustice that exists. Mm-hmm. You got to deal with the fire, not the lava flowing down off the mountaintop. And almost always this gets shortcutted. Now, if we're going to be committed to nonviolent and to be active nonviolent persons, we got to deal with all kinds of things, but the basic place we have to direct our attention is to the injustice in our society, or the injustice of whatever it, and because that's the place that from which all other violence stems. Most other violence, I shouldn't say all violence, but if we direct it at the reactions by those who feel victimized, then we're probably part of the repressive forces. We're probably part of the people that benefit from the status quo. And very honestly, a big bulk of the church in the United States represents those who are benefiting from the status quo. And that's our problem. And I think this is where Jesus has something to say to us. And of course, almost everybody in America, as far as living in a world situation, we benefit from the status quo. Hey, Mexico has this problem. We're going to loan money to Mexico. All we did was guarantee them the money to repay interest and pay off their loans to the wealthy Americans and Japanese and Europeans. Third world countries, for instance, there's more monies that flow from third world countries in interest payments to first world countries, that is, developed countries, than there is in all aid and assistance of any kind that goes from the first world countries to third world countries. But out of the biggest we are, aren't we the most generous nation in the world? There's a whole bunch of things that tomorrow I want to talk just a little bit more about this, but then I want to get on to Jesus said an eye for an eye and a tooth for tooth. That's what you've heard about. But listen, I'm talking about an alternative way. And we'll talk about that. I believe that's the way of nonviolence. By the way, the disciples had been hearing Jesus talk all about this alternative way to the present such offerings, the way that the Romans gave, the Sadducees, the Pharisees, the Essenes, the Zealots. He gave an alternative way to it. And he had been talking about that a great deal. And then they said, well, wait a minute. We've been praying to God as part of these other ways. But if we're going to follow your way, how are we supposed to pray to God? And he said, well, I'll teach you how to pray if you want to follow this way that I'm following. And so he gave him a different way to pray, another prayer. It's called our Lord's Prayer. But it's not a prayer that's appropriate to the ways they were living in the past. It's a way appropriate to the new way that he's talking about as the alternative to the existing systems. In the Lord's Prayer, we've kind of turned it around. And it's a nice, comfortable prayer to pray for those who are part of these systemic, the situation where we're very comfortable. And Jesus' way didn't make most people comfortable. It didn't live them peaceful in the sense that, now they have peace of mind and all. He brought a peace, all right. But it was a peace that had to be asking about Bosnia. They had to be concerned about, you know, the violence that children face, many children face, the violence that women often face in relationship to the male persons, the violence of a society of where poverty is perpetual, the violence of a prison system, and it's, you know, as a way of shutting up those that we want to keep away from us and so on. Jesus has another way. I believe it's the way of nonviolence, and it's the way of love, but a peculiar way.